You're listening to The Impromptu on the Hologram Radio Network, a multifaceted show discussing how technology, art, design, and equality converge on topics that matter most to us. From gaming culture to film and other forms of media, we examine the creative process and how the decisions we make shape our perceptions and lives. This is Alex Knight, and I am joined by Michael Norton. Episode 85, the 2017 Consumer Virtual Reality Expo. Today on the podcast, Michael reports back from his findings on the 2017 Consumer Virtual Reality Expo, some updates on what's going on with respect to the technology and the industry and the developments that are happening, as well as his personal experience with PlayStation VR. Yes, Michael finally bought PlayStation VR and the new Microsoft Surface Notebook. Is it everything that Microsoft purports it to be? And more importantly, is it a MacBook Pro killer? That's coming up next on The Impromptu. When everything is broken and nothing's going right.
Yesterday, I was at a very interesting event, the CVR Expo, Consumer Virtual Reality. Lots of cool talks, cool demos, got to try a bunch of games. A lot of interesting insights into the industry right now. I have a lot of notes, like a ton of notes.
So this is a conference that both consumers can go to, and so it sounds like it's split between showcasing technology products and also it's an event for industry people to go to. They have, yes. I assume somebody is giving some kind of lecture. I mean, who's at this conference?
Okay, so Friday was industry day. So that was the day for people in the industry to go, hear talks, go on the show floor and see demos. And then today and tomorrow, it's open to the public as long as they haven't sold out of tickets. I don't think they have. So yesterday most of the day was talks. I was running back and forth between panels, saw a lot of interesting things. One of the panels was about VR and AR in enterprise, which obviously is of interest to my company because that's essentially where we're focusing right now. We're doing a lot of work with businesses to implement augmented reality with the HoloLens. That, I think, is really where the industry is going. I got the sense that AR is definitely the future for 90% of tasks. And then VR is essentially the immersive experience tool. So VR will be useful for games, for interactive movies, for things of that nature. And then AR will be the tool that you use to do actual work. That was generally the sense I got from all of the speakers there. And I totally agree. I think I've even said this on the show before, mm-hmm. VR, you have this infinite space, but it's ultimately not that useful because you have infinite space. There's no frame of reference. There's no real world information to connect to what you're seeing.
Because there's an entertainment factor to both AR and VR, but just by the nature of what AR allows you to do, that it could be something that's on your phone right now, mm-hmm. that has all these actual practical applications too. It sounds like something that maybe a greater majority of people would be able to use, as opposed to just coming home and slapping on a headset and having some fun, which is fine too.
Now, Microsoft, of course, they're working on mixed reality as well with their upcoming Windows holographic headsets. So in partnership with OEMs like Acer, they're coming out with these VR headsets that have the HoloLens Kinect sensors on them. So not only is it VR, but it is also able to detect everything in the outside world. So with just the headset, it can do the same kind of thing that the Vive and the Rift can do, where it has room scale tracking, except it's going on the headset, meaning instead of outside in, you're getting in outside. It's kind of limited, of course, because it can only see what's in front of you because the sensors are on the front of the headset. But it does offer you enhanced capabilities. So the Vive has a system called Chaperone, and Chaperone essentially shows you where the real walls are. So when you're in a VR game in Vive, this is a feature you can turn on and off. It's on by default. Let's say you're walking towards this wall here by accident. As you walk towards it, a faint blue grid will appear, showing that it's an actual wall in reality.
Okay.
And so with mixed reality, things like that become possible. So even though you're seeing this VR landscape, you're also seeing physical objects and physical geometry. So that you aren't going to, for example, walk into a table or trip over a stool, like things like that. It's also useful because, as with the HoloLens, you can anchor digital content to physical objects. So for example, the demo they gave where they unveiled Windows Holographic at their last big event, they essentially showed it off as you put the headset on at your desk and suddenly your desk is transformed, your office space is transformed into another world. Your desk is still there in physical space, but it's also taking up space in the virtual environment. So you're sitting at your desk and suddenly you have all these apps floating above the desk. So it's VR, but at the same time, physical objects are scanned in, essentially, and it remembers where they are. So, I mean, not only, like, you're basically getting the best of both worlds,
right,
with mixed reality. But
mixed,
of course,
reality, that's going to be now a new term.
Yeah. There's a bunch of terms being thrown around. People are saying mixed reality, virtual reality, augmented reality, XR, extra reality, like, I don't know.
But if we want to get extremely philosophical, reality is what you make it.
Yes.
Isn't it all real? I mean, it's what you perceive as real.
Of course.
Whether it's made up by a computer or not, isn't it all real?
There's there's that speech from Morpheus midway through The Matrix. What is real? How do you define real? I forget.
But
the
no,
rest
joking
of it,
aside,
but
I mean, really, it is just whatever the human, whatever your senses basically translate as input,
yeah,
into the brain. I mean, that's just, that's what it is.
And it's funny because even though it's not yet photorealistic, even though the resolution isn't completely seamless, you still get that primal instinctual response. So like, think about every video you've watched where someone is using VR and things fly at their face, and suddenly they're ducking for cover,
yeah, you're
and
flinching.
Screaming and flinching.
Yeah, happens in movie theaters with 3D now.
Maybe not to the same degree. VR, it's almost universal.
Right.
In fact, I saw people doing that at the conference.
Really?
When they were
trying out
demos. Now,
is that because the screen is right in front of your eyes?
Well, it's not just right in front of your eyes. It tricks you into thinking that what you're looking at is this,
right? Like, okay, got it.
You're suddenly in the game. It's not just you looking at a screen, it's taking up your entire field of vision. So it's as if you're in it. And this particular game was a VR bullet hell game. So you had a shield and a gun, and bullets only affected you if they hit you in the head. So you could actually duck and kind of dodge them, but you also had to use the shield to block. I got to try it, but the person before me, they were playing it, and yeah, the bullets were whizzing by at their face, and they're just going, ah! So even though at an intellectual level, we know it's not real and it doesn't look real, there's still that instinctual level that's like, there are things coming at my face. I need to protect myself. So at a certain level, we do perceive it to be real. And it's only a matter of time before the technology catches up with the intellectual portion. And suddenly we're in these experiences and it seems completely believable. I mean, I'd say within the decade, we're probably going to have like some future version of the Rift or the Vive where it's an 8K micro LED panel. You've got 4K per eye, seamless, beautiful resolution, some insane refresh rate, like 240 hertz, which I think is the refresh rate of the human eye. We can handle 120, but ultimately it needs to go up to 240 to be completely believable. Somewhere around there, I think someone said somewhere. I'd have to look it up again, but I think it's 240. And then obviously a graphics engine that can deliver photorealism and a graphics card that can do that. So the NVIDIA GeForce 2100, I don't know, whatever the GPU is by then.
Yeah.
And then at that point, the headsets will cost like $300 or $400 instead of $1,000. So economies of scale will bring the price down, the tech will get better, and we'll have gotten to this place where suddenly we're in these seamless environments. And that'll be great for games. Like, VR games are a blast to play because it really brings you right there into the action. I'm not sure it'll work for every game, but there's definitely something to be said for kind of immersive story games and immersive storytelling, because once you're in that experience, it's more real and you're more likely to feel the story because there's less of a separation, there's less detachment, because if you're seeing something on a screen, it's like there's that disconnect. You're kind of, yeah, that's not real. It's on my screen. But if you're in there, if you're seeing these things happen right in front of your face, that's a totally different proposition.
Yeah, I really need to experience, and I thought about, because this conference is still going on, so I thought about going, because I actually haven't, we've talked a lot about VR, but I've actually never tried any of the recent VR headsets. I've never tried PlayStation VR, so I really need to experience that, I think, to get a sense of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really incredible. If you can get an opportunity to go to try this stuff, you absolutely should.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts on PlayStation VR, which we've talked about before, but you actually bought it. So you own it now.
Yes. I went to the expo and I was just like, okay, I give in. I have to have VR now. So I went.
Did you actually buy it there?
No. No, I...
That's how badly you wanted it.
No, I reserved it at a Best Buy and I picked it up on the way home. And then I set it up and tried it out. PSVR is really good. It's cheaper than the Rift.
It is the cheapest VR solution that we have.
It is the cheapest VR solution. It's still pricey, like it's $700 here after tax.
Yeah, it's probably not a...
For the bundle.
Yeah, it's probably not a spontaneous buy for many people.
No.
But yes, all things considered, in comparison, it is inexpensive. I mean,
it's essentially half the price.
Yeah.
Because the Oculus is actually cheaper now. It's about $800 for the headset and the touch controllers in a bundle. So they've lowered the price on that. Still fairly expensive.
But Sony is more aggressive on pricing, and I'm sure the cost of the VR headset is going to go down.
Oh yeah.
Over time, just like they do, you know, with consoles over time.
Yeah,
as they age, they drop in price.
As they manufacture it, as they sell it to more people, the cost of manufacturing it goes down and they're able to deliver a cheaper price to consumers. This is true of any consumer product. So I think we could feasibly see a price drop at E3.
Right.
which will suck for me because I just bought it, but
that's kind of what happens though, when you buy stuff, right? So and, so you got this, so you set it up. What games did you play with it?
Okay, so the first game I played was Destiny, which is not VR, but it was still a really cool experience because when you play a game that's not VR supported, you get effectively a 70-inch VR screen that pops up in front of your face.
How is it 70 inches, though? I'm not sure I understand.
Well, like, it's just bigger than the TV that you have,
basically. Okay. Just by the nature of the fact that the screen is, like, an inch away from your eyeball.
Exactly. So
gives it that perceived larger
experience. I mean, it's a little more aliased, for sure.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you're getting this large 1080p screen in front of you.
Is it smooth, though, frame rate-wise?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's definitely smooth. The frame rate, no issues there. It's definitely running at least 90 hertz, probably 120, I think. At least 60 frames a second. With Destiny, it's a little different because Destiny runs at 30. It's capped at 30. I don't know if it's doing any kind of frame interpolation, but it doesn't necessarily have to because it's essentially just floating a screen in front of me. So it doesn't create the dizziness that you would experience with a full immersive game. Like, immersive games, they absolutely have to be 60 or higher, ideally 120 or higher, to avoid motion sickness. But in this case, with just a screen in front of you, it's fine. And it was really cool. Like, not just for regular games, but I could see movies and other stuff. Just having a way bigger screen than you actually have is really impressive.
Sure. No, absolutely.
Like, it's kind of right there in front of you, and you're...
Let me ask you this, though. About games specifically that are not enabled for VR that you do play on the VR headset, is the experience good enough with the headset that you would consider playing, in this case, let's say Destiny, all the time with the headset? Is it good enough that you can comfortably play it in the headset without just, you know, playing it on your TV with a regular controller that like you normally would?
I'd say so. Yeah. It's the PSVR is easily the most comfortable headset because it doesn't clamp to your face. It's like a headband, and then the visor just kind of comes in front of your eyes. You just kind of push this thing and just drag it in and then tighten it a bit at the back. And it adjusts pretty well. Occasionally, it'll kind of like jar loose a bit and the screen will get a little fuzzy. So sometimes you just have to readjust it a little bit, but it's not too bad. I don't know that I'd play games on it all the time, but for when I kind of want to get that big cinematic experience, I think it's beneficial. Like, I would probably consider playing Destiny 2 for the first time with the headset on, just to get that like grandeur. It's kind of like playing a game in IMAX, essentially, because like the screen is the right kind of size that it kind of feels like you're sitting in a theater seat with an IMAX screen in front of you.
Makes you feel small.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. So that's cool. And then this morning I played Job Simulator, which is this ridiculous game where you're a human in the Job Museum in 2070, and it's completely staffed by robots, and they're like showing you VR simulations of what work used to be. So the first one's an office, and these robots whiz by and they're like, "You are really good at business." It's absurd and fun. And then the next one was a chef, and you like, there's so much detail, and the motion controls I don't think are quite as good as the other two, just because it's cheaper and they're essentially just repurposed Move controllers from the PS3, but they get the job done fairly well. And just the act of picking up objects and manipulating them and like throwing them, insanely cool. Like, there is a level of precision with moving your hands that you just don't get with a controller.
It sounds like what I'm hearing is that this is a, obviously there are limitations, but considering the cost and considering this is a 1.0 product from Sony PlayStation, mm-hmm. that this is a pretty good product.
Oh yeah, it's definitely on par. Like I would say, despite like factoring in the price and how much worse it is than the Rift, I would say it's worth a buy over the Rift, because the Rift, it is higher res, but not higher enough to
justify the cost.
And its motion tracking isn't room scale either. So like with PSVR, the room scan is the camera. So the field of play is whatever the camera can see. And this is something that Sony could easily upgrade at E3. They could announce new sensors that you can put in your living room and it'll extend the field of play. Something probably like what Vive is doing with their Lighthouse sensors. Valve Lighthouse is an open source technology that they published to allow VR creators to build better sensors. So those specs are out there. Sony could implement Lighthouse on PSVR if they wanted to. So that's something they could upgrade as an add-on peripheral. The motion controllers, they could upgrade. They could release new ones that are better and more accurate. The headset itself doesn't need to change for a year or two, probably.
Did you test this on a PS4 or a PS4 Pro?
PS4.
I see. So it maybe
fine.
No, I understand that, but I'm just curious if running on the PS4 Pro, which supposedly with the extra processing power, it's supposed to be even smoother. So I'm just wondering if the aliasing artifacts that you saw would maybe be somewhat mitigated by the enhanced processing.
It's possible.
I guess we won't know until we actually test it.
Yeah, and I don't plan on upgrading anytime soon.
Well, especially not with the Xbox Scorpio coming out so soon. Like, we want to see, is Sony going to respond with an updated PS4 Pro? Maybe with even more processing power? Who knows?
It's going to be interesting to see what they do, because, the Scorpio is clearly a better device.
I just don't see the PS4 brand lasting that long to me, because it just seems like the Scorpio is going to be such a significant upgrade that if I were Sony to respond to that, I would just say, here's the PS4 or the PS5. Here's the next major, iteration of our gaming console.
I could see that. I think they've probably been working on it. I think the PS4 Pro is kind of like, it's kind of like a step up. I mean, there wasn't a lot of engineering work that went into it, really. The Pro is just kind of a PS4 with half a PS4 bolted onto it, literally. Like, it's,
I think
they actually soldered on an extra system on chip that's underclocked. So it's like a PS4.
I assume that's
and
partly
half.
Why it's really thick.
Yeah.
Because it probably, and that, and also the extra
the thermal requirements went up for sure. Because there's two chips in there.
Well, technically, actually, when you look, of course, it looks huge next to the PS4 Slim.
Yes.
But when you actually put it side by side to the original PS4, it's actually not that much bigger.
No.
I think it's like a couple of millimeters thicker.
Yeah, it's barely taller.
Yeah. But interesting, though, for Sony, though, I think, it strikes me that they could just put a new GPU in the PS4 5. Basically, take the PS4 Pro that they have now, throw in a UHD player. Mm-hmm. If they're smart, they'll put a UHD Blu-ray player. Increase the GPU, and that's not hard to do because it's like, okay, well, the components are on the market, so upgrade the GPU, upgrade the thermal cooling, and I think the biggest thing from a marketing standpoint, which makes an impact to consumers, is to call it the PS4 5. Or sorry, keep calling it the PS4.
PS4 to 5.
Call it the PS5.
Yeah.
Or whatever, some new name to make it seem like this is a huge, complete redesign.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously what they're working on right now.
I'm sure they're not sitting on their
hands. No, they're not sitting on their hands.
Just,
like, the Scorpio is out there, obviously, and this is Microsoft's big push. Like, this is their play. They're making a console that's more powerful than anything that's been on the market before. In fact, looking at the specs, it's about as powerful as my gaming PC. And my gaming PC is not exactly mid-tier. I've got a 1070 in there. I've got 16 gigs of RAM. I'm going to have the latest generation i5 maxed out. So, I mean, my machine is not exactly a cheap machine.
Yeah, not exactly and a Pentium 2.
No. And the Scorpio is effectively on par with it at 4K. So
I think that's unprecedented in the gaming console business,
yeah,
isn't it?
I mean, it's going to cost more for sure as a result. Like, yeah, this will not be the console that everybody gets for Christmas.
Probably be an extra $100, I'm assuming.
Like, this will start at $599 in Canada, or $699 even. So this will not be...
$599 seems the right price point.
Probably.
Depending
on the manufacturing cost, it could go higher.
Sure.
It's going to be out of people's price range for Christmas, for sure. So they're going to hope that people get the Xbox One S instead. But then, of course, the PS4 Pro, I could see Sony doing a price cut for Christmas, which will make it much more compelling than the Xbox One S. Because the Pro, you've got the power. But then, of course, the Xbox One S has a UHD Blu-ray player.
Yeah.
So...
Is there anything, just going back to the conference for a sec, before we wrap on this, is there anything at the industry level that you can talk about that you found interesting?
Well, there was a panel.
Because you're in this space, right? So you know kind of what the landscape is like, what people are working on, what people are thinking about for the next 12 months.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now the push is essentially to get it out into as many people's hands as possible, drive the cost down, and work on iterating the platforms. So what that looks like is more accurate tracking, higher resolution panels, lower latency, adding in wireless support. That's going to be the big one, because right now the state of affairs is you're tethered to this giant cable, and that's not going to do for a lot of people. So wireless is probably top priority, getting that cable cut so that you are essentially unbound to move in whatever space you want to move around in. That's going to be key. There is an add-on for the Vive right now that's $250 that works for 3 hours before you have to charge it, which is pretty decent. You do also have to plug an adapter into your PC, but other than that, it works completely untethered, which is nice. It's going to take a lot of work before we can get something ubiquitous that's in every headset and that uses less power, because 3 hours is decent right now, but once we start building these long immersive experiences that are multiple hours...
Right.
You're going to need better battery life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Though, on the other hand, I don't know that you should really be wearing a headset for that long. Obviously, we still don't know like what is safe usage for these things, because you've got a screen right in front of your eyes and it's high resolution, sure, but there could be unknown issues with eye strain that we haven't experienced yet because it's still so new. Obviously a lot of that is unknown right now. So,
well, I think the general rule of thumb, even with regular video games, is people in the industry do tend to suggest have spurts of like an hour of gameplay and just give it a rest for a minute, even if it's a 5 minute break to stretch and go walk around, do something,
exactly.
Right. So especially with the VR stuff too. Yeah. I imagine you wouldn't want to have that headset on for more than an hour at a time.
Yeah.
Of course, most people we know are not going to take that advice.
There will be people who are like, I'm in the Matrix now. Forget about meat space. And they just like wear the headset for 6 hours. There will be those outliers. But definitely need to take breaks. So, I mean, 3 hours probably isn't the worst, but it could be better. And the wireless connectivity could be better too. Like... ultimately, what we would want is something that you don't need an adapter for your computer. It just works. So whether that's Bluetooth 5 or Bluetooth 6 down the road, we'll have to see. And then the other general consensus was we are 3 to 5 years from magic AR glasses. So literally a pair of glasses that you put on and you've got AR.
Wow.
Yeah. And one of those products will undoubtedly be Apple's augmented reality glasses.
Yeah, because that's been kind of talked about and even hinted at for a while.
They're working on it.
Right.
In fact, people there were pretty certain that Apple's working on it. So yeah, that'll be interesting to see. I think I'm still pretty confident that they'll cheat a bit and they'll make something lightweight by having the phone do all of the processing. They'll essentially have like a W2 chip in the glasses that allows for high bandwidth connectivity with the phone.
Mm-hmm. Sort of like analogous to the way the Apple Watch works with the iPhone, at least at launch when it came out.
Well, yes and no.
Because the iPhone did the processing, right?
It did at first, yes. But this will be even more so because there will be no CPU in the glasses. It will just be a wireless chip and some sensors and the display tech.
So those glasses are going to be really lightweight, really thin.
Exactly. Ultra slim battery, just enough to keep the sensors running and the connectivity running.
So you can, in theory, they're probably designing it so that you could wear them outside in public and not look like an imbecile.
Exactly. I mean, it's Apple. Of course they're designing it to be like that.
Yeah.
Like, they will not rest until, at worst, it's a pair of Ray-Bans.
I wonder if they'll work with someone like Oakley or something to come up with it. Because weren't there rumors years ago?
Well, that supposedly Google was for Google Glass, but that
Google.
Never
okay.
went anywhere.
Right.
I don't see Apple partnering with anyone. I think Johnny Ive and Newsom, like,
I'm sure he can. He knows what
capable.
It takes to make. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
They're more than capable of designing a pair of glasses.
Yeah.
Some magic whisker thin aluminum shades.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, it'll essentially be an obscenely thin client. Like, there will be no processing happening on those glasses at all. It'll be like the PlayStation VR. So the VR is just a headset. It's a panel and it receives power and HDMI signal from a processing unit that's plugged into the PS4. No onboard processing occurs at all, which is why it's so lightweight and slim compared to the other headsets. That's essentially the approach I see Apple taking, because the glasses really wouldn't be able to do much without the phone anyways.
Yeah.
So you may as well just offload all of the processing power onto the phone, which is already dramatically more powerful than any chip you could cram into a pair of glasses. So, earliest I see them releasing that is 2018, but probably realistically 2019, 2020.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I would be a little surprised if it came out next year.
Yeah.
It just seems little too early.
When I say 2018, I mean September 2018.
Sure, no, of course.
But yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
It's probably more likely spring 2019, like an Apple Watch release sort of timeline. I think the big problem with AR right now is field of view and getting the optical waveguides to work on something that slim. Because right now, the highest field of view, I think, is not the HoloLens. The HoloLens is about, I think it's 60 or 70 degrees. And then there's another pair of AR goggles that are 90 or 100. But we need to get it to 180 for it to be that kind of seamless, I am looking out and there's just things everywhere, instead of like a little window right in front of you. It needs to get to 180. So that we can get the peripherals and just have things floating around as you look every which way.
Right.
And that is the hardest problem to solve because, I mean, you're bouncing light onto this thin visor and trying to somehow get it to work right across your eyes. And we're talking like minuscule optical systems that are like you have to calibrate them just so and tweak the light so that it doesn't get washed out. Just a huge problem.
Yeah.
And there are people working round the clock on it, but it's going to take a little while before we get that FOV up. But it will get there. So yeah, that's the current state of mixed reality right now.
Okay, so for the last portion of the final segment in this episode, let's talk about the Microsoft Surface laptop that came out this week.
Yes.
There's some very interesting things. Now, we have only have about 10 minutes, so we may have to do some follow-up in the next episode. But it appears that Microsoft and their hardware team have managed to come out with a product that, at least on the Surface, and from what I've seen, I swear that was not intentional. it just seems like it's something that really is meant to compete with a MacBook Pro. The commercial, in case people haven't seen it, is very Apple-like.
Oh yes,
very impressive. I think they deserve a lot of credit for what they managed to do in that product promotion. And it looks like a really, really cool product.
It is, though I would not compare it with the Pro. I would call it a MacBook Air Pro. So the reason for that is, at the base level, the specs are essentially comparable to an Air. If you shell out all the money for the higher end ones with the i7, yes, it's closer to a Pro. But you have the caveat of the laptop only has three ports, an SD card slot, a USB 3 port, and a mini display port. That's it. There is no USB-C, there's no Thunderbolt, just those three ports.
Well, that's interesting. I wasn't aware of the I/O on the laptop, but it strikes me as odd that they wouldn't include USB-C on there like Apple did with the MacBook Pro.
Interestingly, in their design video, there was a prototype that had USB-C ports, but for some reason they decided to ditch them.
Maybe because Apple got a lot of flack for USB-C only, and then maybe they decided, well, maybe we shouldn't put USB-C.
It clearly wasn't USB-C only, that's the thing. And if they were worried about it, they could have just included one.
Right, right.
Like, at least have one. And then you could actually ditch your magnetic connector and use that USB-C port to charge the thing.
It's nice that they include an SD card reader, though, because Apple took that out of the Mac Pro. I mean, didn't the MacBook Pro have that for a while, and then they took it out?
The Air still has it, and the old Pro still has it. They're trying to save some space. Yeah. I mean, they're probably banking on the fact that anyone that needs it will probably just have a USB card reader.
What's the battery life on this thing? What are they advertising?
They're advertising 14 hours.
So that's impressive. That's MacBook Pro levels.
That's better than MacBook Pro levels.
Yeah.
MacBook Pro is still 10 hours.
Oh, is it? Okay. Maybe it was the Air, the current Air is
the current Air is 11 or 12 hours.
Okay. All right. So it is better than the MacBook Pro battery life.
Yeah. Though they quote that as being with Windows 10 S, which is the other thing they
announced. Which is not out yet.
Which is not out yet. It's a new streamlined version of Windows 10 that is locked down, meaning you can only run apps that are from the Windows Store.
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
It is.
That's a first for Microsoft.
Not really.
No?
It's effectively the same as Windows RT. That version of Windows 10 that kind of disappeared rather quietly. It was shipped with the original Surface devices and then kind of died when they announced the Surface Pro.
Yeah. So what's the rationale behind that? Is it because Microsoft finally realizes that they need to have some control over their platform and not let any willy-nilly app on their system that'll wreak havoc on the system? Because I think that's where a lot of the bad reputation that, I mean, Microsoft has made design mistakes in their operating system, but I think a lot of the sort of the usability, poor experience stuff comes from third-party apps that are not made by Microsoft, that are not exactly well-behaved, you know?
It has, but we're talking about a desktop operating system, and up until now, one of the core tenets of a desktop operating system is you can install whatever you want. That's still true of macOS, and it's still true of Windows, and it's more than true of Linux.
Right.
Though, I mean, technically, Linux Apple, doesn't really come into the conversation.
Apple does give you the preference, but technically, you could lock down Mac OS if you wanted to and say only allow Mac App Store software yes. if you really wanted to. Of course, nobody does that.
No. And in fact, Mac OS Gatekeeper, by default, it's Mac App Store apps and trusted apps that have been signed by an Apple developer.
Yeah.
You can then either go all the way to the left and say only Mac App Store apps, or you can go to the right and say any app
right.
at all. And I mean, there's something to be said for either approach, but I think the reasoning behind these particular decisions from Microsoft, at the event where they announced all of these things, their focus was education. So for education devices, there's a very different set of needs. You need devices that you can provision really quickly, that you can set up for new students at the start of a year, and they can use those devices year round.
And that they'll maintain reliability.
Yes, exactly. They won't load it up with viruses, et cetera, et cetera. So Windows 10S is essentially an answer to all of those problems. So one of the things they talked about was you can provision a device with Windows 10S in like 2 minutes with a USB stick that has it on it.
Oh, wow.
So you just stick it in, turn on the computer, and bam, Windows 10S is already installing. They said that one school district, they gave Windows 10S to them, and they were able to provision like 400 devices in a single day.
Wow.
So it's offering, like, this is an offering for schools, absolutely. And that's really also what the Surface laptop is. It's a device for students. It's a device for schools. And the reason for those older ports is because schools have older technology. So projectors, that kind of thing, those are all using older tech. There's no USB-C projectors at a public school or even a university right now. So it completely makes sense for Microsoft to offer a device that still has that legacy support. Plus, a lot of students tend to take photos with their cameras if they're in like a photojournalism course or some kind of creative course, and they need to be able to get those photos onto their computer as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So the SD card slot makes sense. And then USB, obviously, pretty much everything is USB, and they can buy cheap accessories for it and it'll work. So, I mean, from that standpoint, it completely makes sense. For power users like us, yeah, it definitely leaves something to be desired. But that being said, it's still a really great device if you're not at the cutting edge of tech. If you're looking for a somewhat cheaper alternative, it's a device that will undoubtedly be as fast, if not slightly faster, than the Air or the Pro. It lasts longer than both. It's got a better screen that fully supports touch and the Surface Pen. The only downside, I would say, is for some unfathomable reason, they decided to line the entire top, the part with the keyboard and the trackpad, with Alcantara. So that is the high-quality synthetic velvet material that is on the signature type cover for the Surface Pro. And it is probably the stupidest material choice for a laptop. Because we're talking...
Considering that your hands are typically a source of attracting dirt and
not
grease.
Not only that, but a laptop for students.
Right.
If you go onto the website for Alcantara and look up how to take care of it, you know what it says? Every day, you should brush it. Every week, you should clean it with a damp cloth. And every year, you should wash it with soap.
I understand, I think, where Microsoft was going with this, that they wanted to create this premium feel, this premium high-quality material.
Well, no. But they described it as they wanted it to feel natural. So like a carpet
there's
or something.
Nothing natural about a computer.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, like so
that was their reasoning. But yeah,
it's odd.
It's stupid.
It may come back to bite them.
I think it will, because this material is not going to hold up to students like rubbing
their hands. No, I agree. I think it'll look nice for the first couple of months, and then like two or three years down the road, it's not going to look
good. Yeah, like my coworker, he got their new ergonomic keyboard that has a palm rest made of Alcantara. It's already showing grease stains, and he's only had it for like a month or two.
Right.
So imagine what these laptops are going to look like.
Yeah, it's not
after
going
a year.
Work out very well for Microsoft, but we'll probably have to revisit that. And I'm sure there will be reports of problems and complaints
from
customers.
We'll see how that turns out.
Yeah.
The other shoe is about to drop. So they just announced an event in Shanghai for May 23rd. I know, kind of odd. Not sure why Shanghai, but we'll go with it.
Well, it's a very like happening city from a tech standpoint.
It's just unusual for a major company keynote. But I mean, they're probably making the stuff there, so kind of makes sense. So that'll be the event where they likely announce the Surface Pro 5 and the Surface Book 2. And possibly a spec bump to the Surface Studio. And maybe some other things. So that'll round out their product lineup for the year, essentially. Like, that'll be the real MacBook Pro killer, essentially. So that'll be interesting to keep an eye on.
You've been listening to the Impromptu One Hologram Radio. I'm Alex Knight, joined by Michael Norton, as always. If you'd like to show your support for this podcast and the work that we do here, the single best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/hologramradio and donate today. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes to ensure you get every new episode each and every week. And do leave us a review if you have a moment that makes us feel good, as well as helps other people find the podcast. We're also available in Google Play Music, TuneIn, and Stitcher as well if you'd like to stream it there. And wherever else you can find podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at The Impromptu. Michael Norton is at Zen Impulse. I'm at Zero Distraction. And if you'd like to send us feedback the old-fashioned way, you can email us at theimpromptu@hologramradio.org, and that will go to both myself and Michael.
And on that note, thanks for listening, everyone. See you next time.